Insader, Hispan TV Noticias.
En otras noticias, las críticas de Washington a la selección china de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica.
En los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
grupos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got 3/4 of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundacion Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
Where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've strayed on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways, stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans, been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard, and it's hard, 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 hard. It's a hard rain gonna fall. What have you seen, my blue-eyed son? What have you seen, my darling young one? I saw a newborn babe with the wild wolves around it. I saw a highway of golden with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with a blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. Saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. Saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's hard, 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 hard. It's a hard rain's gonna fall.
And up next on your God Knows What dial, it's the archive and also the live, well, canned, but just recently canned, edition of Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides, the May 5th, 2022 edition. And we're going to be actually beginning with that half of a flashback from about 6 or 7 years ago. I guess it's 7 years ago now. September 10th, 2015. Rebecca Mills. You're going to hear a long interview with Rebecca from jail. She will enlighten you as to why she's there. And it kind of touches on some of the issues that came up at today's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom discussion of protections of people who are threatened with psychiatric incarceration or a reduction of their competency status, or just folks in jail, I guess. It might even be a broader category. You can check this out if you wish. If you want to hear the full show, you can actually go onto the Huff website and find it. Just look for the September 10th, 2015 show under the appropriate archive link. And the name of all the shows as a group is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Like Robespierre and Bathrobe together. Bathrobes, Piers. Also, this flashback has discussion of Alex and Joff, who are artists who are arrested and jailed on the street for showing their artwork outside, I guess what would now be the disced areas. If you look on the sidewalk carefully along Pacific Avenue, you'll see these four discs in a square shape or a rectangular shape where people were supposed to be wedging themselves in. It's not enforced as of yet, but I suspect enforcement is coming because they recently passed essentially a new display device law. They called it a vending law. And when I refer to the blue boxes in this 2015 flashback, what I mean are the blue marks on the sidewalk that are in box-like, they enclose a box-like area that you were supposed to wedge yourself into. You're going to hear old Lucera Luna, or actually young Lucera Luna, but in olden times, and my discussion of the illegal merchant signs, which these authorities had no problem tolerating. And, there's also a third segment, and the third segment is an interview with Wes White by phone, the Salinas, California homeless activist guy, who is concerned about upcoming sweeps in the Carmel area, if you're familiar with that area in Monterey County, down in the Monterey Peninsula. And he gives us a broad-ranging report, and that sort of tops off the show. My apologies for the lack of general absence of music on this show. I'm in the best of health, I don't know, weary from too many wild parties. That would be nice if that had happened. But in any case, you're going to get what you're going to get today, and hopefully you'll be able to enjoy some of it. And as usual, pick up some tips. Who knows? Enjoy if you can.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. history's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle.
Welcome to another edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. This is going to be a two-hour show, as usual, probably the last of three shows of mine, unless something unusual happens. Free Radio Santa Cruz has not found a studio. If you have any ideas about a studio, you should call us at 423-4833. That's actually my number, 423-HUFF. And we'll rush out and see if we can use the space, since we can pay for it. But we're looking for a 10 by 10 space, and we don't get it, we're gone. We're going to start moving this coming Sunday, but we'll actually go off the air the next Sunday. So you do have, I guess, three more of my shows. At least that's from my perspective what I'm focusing on. However, on the line with us from the Hooskow is Rebecca. Is it Mills, Rebecca?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, I want to make sure I've got you. Can you hear me clearly?
Yeah.
Good. So, Rebecca, you may I don't know if our listeners remember. Some of them may. I did do two recorded interviews with you from jail about 3 or 4 months ago. You were you've been facing trial for over a year, and they've delayed your trial based upon a claim that you are incompetent, correct?
Yeah, that's what's going on. Well, it got delayed, then it got reinstated, and then it got delayed again, and then there's a recommendation in now that I am competent, but the judge just won't accept that, and he's sending me back to the state hospital, which is the people that made the recommendation that I am competent to stand trial.
And that's Judge Volkman that you were telling me.
Yeah.
And what was it that led in your uppity behavior for him to try to cut you out of the trial process?
Well, I wasn't getting along with my attorney. I, wanted to fight the charges that I'm facing, which are not really super serious charges. I, had a conflict with my neighbors. The police were called. I ended up getting charged with burglary, criminal threats, and resisting arrest. My attorney made promises to me and didn't follow through, and I couldn't reach her and all this stuff. I tried to get her replaced, and I guess in the courtroom, the judge didn't get me. And I don't know, I tend to talk fast. I'm intelligent. I don't know. So I guess he took that the wrong way the first time that I was, you know, that's the first time a doubt was raised as to my competency, was when I was trying to get a lawyer that would work with me. And then, you know, that kind of casts a pall over everything that goes after it. So it just was a snowball from there, really, because they had one evaluator come in and speak with me at the time. I was having a back problem. I was trying to, you know, just get the interview over with really quickly. He was taking notes. He didn't really, you know, ask me for any feedback, or, you know, he just kind of took notes on my answers to his questions. And then when I did finally get access to his report, you know, he admits in his report I was talking too fast for him to follow, you know, and that to him was a sign of mania. But he never asked me to slow down or clarify anything, you know, and he just misrepresented what I said. And then later on, I found out that if in the law it says that if the defendant wants to contest a finding of incompetency, that they're supposed to have two evaluators, and they didn't do that. But anyway, I went down to the state hospital. I was lucid. They talked to me. I got sent back, you know, recommended to send back the third day I was there. And then 10 days later, came back up here, and they were like, that's a record turnaround for someone that goes, you know, on an incompetent stand trial. I got restored to competency. Things continued. And then when it got close to trial again and I hadn't been able to work with this attorney, she hadn't even shown me the evidence that was supposed to prove that I was, you know, guilty or, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. And they raised another doubt as to my competency, had, you know, people write reports about. Anyway, so that's a long answer to a short question.
No, it's a good answer. I mean, it brings us somewhat up to date. Name of your attorney, or was it one attorney or more than one attorney you had problems with?
Yeah, one attorney. I mean, I had originally been assigned one person, and then when I wanted to proceed beyond the preliminary hearing stage, my case got reassigned to this other lady who had it for over a year. And then something fortuitous for me is that she decided recently to leave the public defender's office as of a little over a week ago, I guess. And so I've been trying for over a year to get a new attorney, to get someone who, you know, won't lie to me, who will work with me, who will present the evidence to me and help me, you know, fight these charges. And, you know, and I hadn't been able to do that through the court process. And then, you know, through this kind of, what I say, act of God, I got to find someone else who seems like I'll be able to work with.
What was the name of the attorney that is leaving the office?
Her name was Amy Buenteo, and I don't know what she's moved on to. And, you know, I mean, I guess she has done a good job for some of her clients. And that's what the judge was basing his denial of my you know, request on, was, you know, he said at the first time that I tried to get her replaced.
Rebecca, again, can you spell her last name for me?
That's Buenteello.
Huh, okay. I mean, I myself have had many problems with attorneys, and they rarely do what I want without very, very careful direction. But I'm very, very picky, you know. I mean, I'm usually looking at it from an activist standpoint rather than, the standpoint of a person simply trying to get the maximum legal mileage out of an attorney, which is, you know, fair to do as well. So you're accused right now of burglary, criminal threats, and resisting arrest. What are you accused of burglaring?
Well, that's a charge, and I mean, I shouldn't go into too much detail because, you know, it's whatever, you know, anything I say can be used against me.
Yeah.
But that charge can be made when you enter a building with the intent to commit a felony. I mean, most people think that you're stealing something, that has to be part of that charge. That's not true. If you're entering a place with an intent to commit a felony, that charge applies, and that's how they're trying to use that. And they, I mean, the DAs tend to try to overcharge so that you can, you know, bargain down from there. So I had a hearing. The one thing that my old attorney did do, that she said she would do, that it took, you know, over going on a year to actually have happen, was a motion to dismiss based on the idea that I was unable to inform intent to commit these crimes, which, you know, require intent. And so at the hearing for that, there was a little bit of a discussion with the judge and the DA there. And the issue was brought up, okay, what felony did Ms. Mills have an intent to commit? And the DA was kind of like at a loss. He's like, kidnapping? And I'm just like, that's just, you know, blatantly ridiculous. I mean, I did not want these neighbors around me. I mean, we were having a conflict, and, you know, I believe they provoked me and you know, did some things. Anyway, Rebecca, they misrepresented what happened.
It sounds to me like they're trying to have it both ways. Either if they claim you're incompetent, are they also claiming that you had the intent, the requisite intent to commit a burglary at the same time,
well,
as you're incompetent?
It's just happening at different points in time, right? So incompetent is while you're in the court process, whereas being able to have intent would be during the time at which the events occurred that you're charged with the crime for. So they're related but not the same, right? Because it's different points in time. But, you know, a lot of people who aren't with it mentally would be both incompetent and, you know, because of whatever mental illness or defect, unable to form intent to commit whatever they're charged with if it's a crime of intent.
So as I understand, now they're trying to send you back to Patton State Hospital again for another competency investigation or mental health treatment.
Yeah, well, it's not a new. It's just refusing to accept it. They haven't had any new evidence presented. He just refused to accept the recommendation that was made. It's kind of a finger-pointing game at this point where, I mean, the judge, I've had the appearance, like 3 days after I came back up here, I've been waiting over a month now, but I had a court appearance on August 6th, and I thought, because this has happened once before, I thought, okay, I'll be restored to competency, my case will resume, we'll see what happens. And that didn't happen, so that was a bit of a shock. And then he had scheduled a status conference update kind of court date just to see how things were going for the 26th, which I wasn't required to attend if I was at Patton, but I hadn't been transported. So, you know, he was kind of saying, okay, well, Patton made a mistake, and why is Rebecca here? And it's like, well, that's actually not true. You're the one that made the mistake in not accepting their recommendation. But it's a little bit confusing to this county because the psychiatrist down there, there's like a clause that they can invoke that says that they're afraid that you might lose your competency if you're not under continued treatment, right? And so since they've seen me twice on this same case, he's like, we don't want to see you again, so we're going to make the recommendation that, you know, instead of being in jail, you be in a treatment facility while your case proceeds so that we make sure we don't see you again. And that really backfired because this is a small county, and they've never seen that recommendation. They don't know what to do. They don't know if there's any facilities around here that qualify. And the judge sees the term treatment facility and thinks Patton, which it is, but it's not satisfactory for me to be at while my case is in progress.
Hey, slow down.
400 miles away.
Maybe get you to slow down, Rebecca, because you are...
sorry.
No, you're packing a lot of power into a short space of time, and you have only about, I guess, 5 or 7 minutes left before the jail phone system shuts you down, right?
Yeah, I can make calls out, but they limit each individual call to 15 minutes, so I can call back. But
and
yeah,
are they charging you per
again.
Are they charging you per call, or is it gonna, are you getting?
Oh yeah, yeah. If they're charged no matter what. It's either collect and someone else pays, or I pay outgoing. Yeah.
Now I know you set up a website. You told me last time we talked. Is your website still up? Is information on it if folks are interested in getting more and learning more about your case?
Yeah, there's some stuff up there. I mean, that's, you know, because I'm in jail and I don't have access to do things myself, it kind of depends on friends having time to do things. I sent out a lot of content to a friend of mine. He hasn't had time to post it all. There's a few things up there. But it's still active. It's just not, you know, current.
And what is that? What is that website?
It's my name, RebeccaMills.org. I have an unusual spelling of my first name. It's R-E-B-E-K-A-H and then M-I-L-L-S.
Yeah.
And I think he's in the process of posting some additional material, but because some of it's sensitive and, you know, whatever, related to my criminal case, I think he's going to pass or protect a bunch of it. Anyway, I'm in communication with him on that.
Mm-hmm. I spent some time talking to you about jail conditions while you were in jail, and mm-hmm. you talked about which part of the jail you're being held in?
D unit. So they've changed things around actually in the past couple of weeks from how it's been for quite a while. I don't know if you heard about this situation. They had originally had two open units for females, G and H, and G was a larger unit and H is a smaller one. And they started this recovery program a couple weeks ago, and that's happening in H unit, so that's only for people that are in that program now. So the only open unit for females that, as of now, and I don't know, as long as they stick with this, is G, and that's where I'm at.
I know you also stated that you're having some problems with some of the inmates at that time, and what's your perspective? Has it changed in terms of what's your relationship with the other inmates?
Well, some of the people that I had the greatest kind of issues with are now over in the program, and I'm not there, so that's a bit of a relief. And, you know, they've been sentenced or whatever. They're just, you know, they're doing their thing. They're on their own path. And, you know, I just...
1 minute remaining.
We're almost out of time. I could call you back if you want. But I just, you know, kind of as a personal growth thing, kind of came to realize that the way I was reacting to them was not helping my situation and was not helping them. And, you know, so it was kind of better to... not stand my ground on certain things. And, you know, I was really upset more with jail staff for not holding them in line and allowing them to get away with harassing me and threatening me and being just really shady to me. And when I complained about it, just basically doing nothing.
So what was your eventual outcome? You can call back if you want. Depends how you feel about it. If you want to talk some more, you can.
Yeah, no, I'll call back.
All right. Then we got about, 30 seconds or something? Or?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
So we'll be cut off at any moment. We're talking with Rebecca Mills from the, Unit H, is that right?
G unit in the county jail.
G unit, D as in David, right?
G as in George.
G as in George. Okay, well then, call us back and give us the real George, Rebecca.
Okay, there you go.
Thank you for using IC Solutions.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
And that's a call from jail from Rebecca Mills, and you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. These are the closing broadcasts of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We still have a $500 reward. Yeah, it's gone up. If you can find us a studio space, that doesn't mean a transmitter space. It's just a space where we can locate our broadcasting online equipment, which is completely legal, and we'll pay. We're thinking of anywhere from $300 to $500. And we need it pretty badly if we're going to continue the station again. Is that we move for sure on the 21st. We begin dismantling next Sunday on the 13th. So get in touch. Give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's my number, the number also of Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And let me know if you got some ideas, any kind of leads. Ask around if you like these shows, if you like having free radio in the community. That's the way it's going to continue. I will look for alternate means of broadcasting the show, but no promises. I am not the most techie savvy guy, so you have to consider that. Sounds like our jailbird is calling back. Hi there, you're on
Hello.
Free Radio.
You have a call at no expense to you from
Rebecca Mill,
an inmate at the Santa Cruz County Correctional Facility. To accept this call, press or say 5. At any time. Thank you for using IC Solutions. You may begin speaking now.
Hello?
Hey, Rebecca, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. So, do you know if anyone else has been in your situation? Have you met anybody else who is also being held on this competency concern?
I mean, so from Santa Cruz, I mean, obviously when you go to the state hospital, they have entire units. They have like 400 people down there from, you know, all over California, mostly from those neighboring counties down there that are held on that status. So I met quite a few. From this county, there's a handful, you know, every so often that go down.
What's the, is there any standard kind of course of action that happens to people who are in this, sounds like a kind of a limbo?
Well, I'm in kind of a really, really obviously a limbo situation because the normal thing that happens is a recommendation is put in, you know, to restore someone to competency. They get restored, and they want to cut a deal as soon as possible, and their case gets resolved, you know? And so I'm, because I've been down there twice, and I'm still trying to fight to get a not guilty verdict or get a really deal that's acceptable to me, which would not involve a felony. I mean, I believe my neighbors lied and provoked me and, you know, all kinds of things, and they're just not credible, and they're the only ones who are, you know, really alleging that I committed a crime. And anyway, that whole thing, I'm not willing to, you know, I'm holding out, and that's very, very atypical. Most people want to get out of jail as soon as possible, and, you know.
Let me ask you, Rebecca, who's the DA who's handling your case?
I think, at least for my last several court appearances, it's been Jesus Delgadillo.
Jesus Delgadillo?
Yeah.
And has he been offering you deals of any kind?
I had a deal that was offered right before I was found incompetent in trial in April, or right before they raised the doubt of, you know, whether I was competent and initiated those proceedings. And just the poor communication with my attorney. I mean, when I was meeting with her and she mentioned it included a felony, she said, I don't want to take a felony. She didn't even tell me all the terms of the deal, and it was only recently that, you know, she just kind of stormed off, whatever. It was only recently that I was able to get the terms of that deal, which, you know, I wasn't willing to take a felony. But, you know, they're trying to get me to plead to, at that time, was felony vandalism with a 3-year probation with a lot of conditions on it.
And do you have a prior record, if you care to say?
Not really. I mean, I have 2 misdemeanors for disturbing the peace. I don't have any significant criminal history.
Did you plead or were you convicted of disturbing the peace?
Yeah, those were both plea deals. I was charged originally with other things, and one of them I was in custody when I entered a plea, and the other one I wasn't. I was just showing up to court.
Were these both in Santa Cruz, or were they out of the area?
Oh, no, those were in other jurisdictions. No, this is the first time I've dealt with the Santa Cruz law enforcement justice system. No, one of them was in Santa Barbara in, like, 2009. They were kind of close together in 2009 when I was going through a difficult period where I was having some issues with my family. But, one was in Santa Barbara and one was in down near, like, Palm Springs.
So, you have been in jail now for how long?
14 and a half months. Well, I mean, in custody, I was at Patton in total at the state hospital for 2 times for a total of, like, 2.5 months. So, like, basically a full year in county and then also, like, 2.5 months down in Patton.
Where's the food better? Food better, Patton? Or?
Oh, definitely a Patton. Definitely a Patton. They actually have, like, fresh vegetables. They have all kinds of, yeah, they have better food and more of it. And, yeah. And you can get things sent to you there. You can get things that aren't available here. Anything that's from a legitimate vendor that's not listed as contraband, you can have sent in to you.
Huh. And whereas in this jail,
you can't do that at jail.
What's the situation here?
Jail, you can buy things off commissary and you can get printed materials, and that's basically it. You know, you can get people to send you books or, you know, things in the mail like paper, written stuff. And you can buy what they have on the commissary, which is, you know, 95% junk food.
Any access to the law library here in the Santa Cruz County Jail?
They don't have a law library per se. The way that they satisfy the legal requirements to provide access to legal research materials is they have a contract with the Legal Research Service, and you submit a request for materials related to a specific subject, and they kind of mail them back to you, and then you kind of read them and see if it's what you want.
Sounds pretty cumbersome.
It takes a while, and if you don't get what you want, there's really not much, you know, like if you requested something specific and they just misunderstood it, you have to re-request it and hope that maybe you get what you wanted.
Have you had many visitors while you've been in jail?
Well, I'm not from Santa Cruz. I moved to Santa Cruz in, like, September 2012. I was a student up at UCSD, and I studied massage, and I was wrapping that up right before I got arrested. And so I didn't have a lot of local people that were able to, you know, be coming to visit. I've had two different people come visit me here. I have a friend from massage school, and then my mother came up. She's in Santa Barbara County. She came up a few times. I've had some family. I've actually had a couple of family members just as one-offs, like around Christmas, that were, you know, traveling for Christmas and what have you. But, yeah, as far as regular visitors, you know, like, it's been difficult. That's one thing that's been difficult, because I don't have the local support, and you don't, you know, your life gets put on hold, and they don't care when you get arrested, you know? And then how are you going to handle your personal business? How are you going to do this or that? They don't care, you know?
So what is, have you, you know, when you, if you ask for a, you know, for a writ of habeas corpus, they say, what, you've had your hearing in Volkman's court, he's declared you, you had a competency hearing, and they declared you incompetent about a year ago? Is that when that happened, or?
No, so the current one that's pending, that's effective, the initial one was in September, and I was restored to competency in December. Usually you have to wait a while to go down to the state hospital, like I'm waiting now. So then the new one was the end of April, and then I had, you know, I'm still not been restored to competency, even though that's the recommendation of, you know, the experts at the state hospital. So I'm just, you know, so yeah, a writ of habeas corpus would be appropriate in this situation. I filed a couple of writs previously before I got denied here, just based on the irregularity of the initial finding, where they only had one expert and it should have been two, and, you know, okay, that wasn't legit, and that denied me my speedy trial. And anyways, all those writs got denied in the, and then at this most recent one that I wasn't given the opportunity to offer any of my own testimony. They just based the decision solely on these written reports from these psychologists that are really riddled with factual errors and misinterpretations. And, you know, if I would have had an opportunity to say anything about them, maybe, it, you know, the ruling would have gone differently. Anyway, those were denied kind of without addressing the legal issues by the another judge in the Santa Cruz court. So to have those pursued, I would have to file those in the Court of Appeal, which is kind of hard to figure out how to do for my current situation.
What was it? Who was the judge? Rebecca, who was the judge who denied you in the other court?
Paul Maragonda.
Oh, of course. Wow. Well, what kind of support are you seeking from people outside who are interested in your case? I mean, it's all pretty obscure is one of the problems. I mean, it sounds like, you know, a kind of mini Guantanamo situation to me, because you're being held essentially.
Yeah, in a way it is, yes. I mean, I'm like I said, I do have a new public defender who I think will be good for me.
What's the name of the new public defender?
Her name is Athena Reese.
Say it one more time.
Athena Reese.
Spell it.
R-E-I-S, and then Athena, the A-T-H-E-N-A.
Gotcha.
As far as my concerns that I had, that I wouldn't get, like, a vigorous defense that would explore all the, you know, possible defenses and give me, you know, the best chance of being found not guilty, I'm, you know, working with her, and I hope that, you know, that will happen. But nothing can happen until I'm restored to competency, you know? And I'm not sure how much he's willing or able to do on that, you know? So,
what's the process for getting... What's the process for getting restored? What's the process for getting restored to competency?
Well, the judge has to, just say that he's, you know, found me competent at trial. So, I mean, if I didn't do anything special, I'll get sent down to Patton. They'll figure out to issue another recommendation and send me back up here. He'll have to have another hearing where hopefully he'll, you know, accept their recommendation. And then, you know, I mean, the judge ultimately has to accept the recommendation that I am competent to stand trial. Now, the way to go around that would be, like you mentioned, a writ of habeas corpus, you know? Like, I could file one about my current situation, which is just, I don't have access to, you know, an office here, or I could have done it a long time ago. But, you know, to make copies, to make phone calls, to do this, to do that. But I could file a writ about my current situation to try to, like, kind of end run that process and say, you know, I should have been restored to competency. The experts say I am competent. There's no reason why, you know, my trial shouldn't continue or, you know, charges should be dropped because, my trial's been unconstitutionally delayed. I was told by a private attorney when I was looking into getting private attorneys that if that happens, you know, it's up to the prosecutor to refile charges. So it might, you know, not help in the long run. But at least it would, you know, get out of this competency kind of never land.
Well, indeed. I think I'm going to leave it there unless there's more you want to add.
One of the things is, you know, when I came into custody, I was really not doing well physically with my health. And my health concerns, and just in general, you know, the way that inmates are treated who have legitimate health problems here is just really terrible. Some of the people, I mean, it's a contractor that provides the medical care here. It's the same contractor that's being sued in a class action in Monterey County, you know, for providing inadequate care.
The name of the contractor is?
Forensic Medical Group Incorporated, I believe.
Okay.
And I mean, like, just all kinds of things where I was just, you know, denied care in a really obvious way. I mean, I had a back surgery 10 years ago for, you know, disc herniation. I was having new symptoms related to that, and they were claiming that I didn't have any symptoms, not providing me even anti-inflammatory medication for that. Because, I mean, if you just have shooting nerve pain and you don't do a physical exam and you just look at someone, you can easily deny that they're having any issue, you know? Meanwhile, there is severe pain, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, that's just one example. I had unexplained fever. I had unexplained high blood pressure. They didn't do any monitoring on that. Just all kinds of stuff. They it's just ridiculously negligent care. You know, I had it just goes on and on. And I'm healthy now, and so that's, you know, a relief. But I was trying for the longest time to get proper care, proper treatment, proper diagnosis, and I was just left hanging.
Rebecca, let me interrupt and say, if people want to correspond with you, how should they write to you?
At the jail, so as long as I'm here, they can send me correspondence here, but like I mentioned, I'll probably be going to Patton soon, and then mail will get returned to sender. My address here, it's my name, and then my S number, which is 249725, and then the jail address, Santa Cruz Main Jail, 259 Water Street, Santa Cruz, California, 95060. I don't know. I mean, I suppose once I get transferred to Patton, you know, I would have a new, they have their own identification numbers, but if people just use my name and then the address at Patton, which is 3102 East Highland Avenue, Patton, California, and let me see, 92369, they should be able to find me, I guess.
Well,
it just depends. I'm in kind of limbo as far as where I'm going to be, too. Any kind of postal mail might get lost.
If you want, send me a letter or keep me advised.
One minute remaining.
Let me give you got a pencil for my address. It's Robert Norris.
Yeah, I'll need to get your address. Maybe I can call you back later.
Yeah, why don't you do that? We'll talk again. And thank you for calling in. We'll be talking with Rebecca Mills. I got that right. And again,
yes.
You can reach her at the moment. She's S249725, Santa Cruz Main Jail, 259 Water, 95060. And if you need to find out that address again, call me on the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And you can talk to a genuinely incompetent woman who sounds pretty competent.
Okay.
Thanks, Rebecca, for calling me. Bye-bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM. I'm Robert, and this is Bathrob Spears Broadsides in the fourth to last show of mine on Free Radio, barring unusual circumstances. We're hoping that we will find those unusual circumstances through you and be able to give you a $500 finder's fee for finding us a place where we can do a studio, and that doesn't requires only a 10x10 space, more or less, a place where we can set up a shed even in a backyard, provided we have access to electricity. So get in touch at 423-4833 if you want to help us with that And it's you can keep this show going if that's what you want to do. Let's do a little music, and I'll be back.
Santa Cruz, California.
Pacific Avenue. It's a beautiful day. A little warm for my taste, but not quite too hot. And my two favorite artists are here with their display devices, Joff and Alex. And they're not being bothered by police. In fact, I've even heard of a victory sign or a peace sign has been passed by. So that's good by the police. On the other hand, there are no blue markings, which might be good too, indicating that the city's blue marking department has not been busy, which is good. Also, I heard the word that, as far as I know, and I don't think this is in confidence, there'll be a continued activity in the courtroom of Commissioner Baskett in a couple of weeks on this case. And this, of course, these are the two artists who were arrested for being outside the blue boxes after the blue boxes themselves were removed. I believe they were severely restricted, and Alex and Joff, who you may have seen downtown, large artists free and other displays that 6 feet high, their paintings were hung on it in all four different directions, and it was a pretty compact display. I think it actually met the restrictive requirements of the earlier ordinance. The current ordinance states that you cannot have a performance or display device of any kind. Meaning a subject capable of holding tangible things outside of either the blue, yellow, or red boxes. I guess those are the colors. And then recently they eliminated all but the blue boxes, and even more recently they eliminated even those, so there are no boxes. So in actual fact, by my reading of it, all performers downtown who have a display device, all political tablers, all vendors are illegal. And the police apparently are not going after them, at least I haven't heard that's the case. Alex and Joff went to court, and you're going to hear me talking more about it. They apparently, in my view, made the mistake of going into Baskett's court and not disqualifying her, which is, I think, always a mistake. And so she had a trial with them. Usually the first time you appear in someone's court, you get an arraignment, but Alex and Joff are in an unusual situation. I may have talked about this before. I hope I'm not repeating myself. Because they were taken into court initially, immediately, by the police in an unusual procedure that normally is only invoked by the individuals who are being victimized by the police, that is, say, the vendors or the people that are getting arrested by the police. They say, take me to a magistrate, and if it's during court hours, the police are obliged to take them there for a probable cause hearing, at which point the magistrate assigns them a court for a trial. And I think that's what apparently happened in this case. I think it was Judge Gallagher or some such assigned Joff and Alex, the two artists, to Baskett's courtroom for trial.
And normally, the usual procedure is you have to disqualify a judicial officer, whether a commissioner or a judge. You have one simply blank check disqualification. That's called a peremptory challenge before the arraignment or at the arraignment. Actually, I think you can probably do it after the arraignment, too, by my reading of the code. But usually it's done before the clerk, the court, when you go up to make your trial date to start with. You file a paper saying, I want to disqualify this person. Or you go do it in court when you actually appear there. You say, I want to disqualify you because I believe you're prejudiced. And you don't have to give a lot of explanation. You don't have to prove anything. You just have to state it. But apparently Alex and Joff decided not to do that, and so they had a trial with only one witness, Keith McHenry, as far as I know. I had thought for sure they were disqualifying Baskett, so I wrote about their case. I put it up on Santa Cruz Indie Media, but I advised people that they prefer to have people go to their trial and not to their arraignment, which would be delayed because they'd be sent into a new court. I don't know if it would be an arraignment or a trial, but it would be a delay, certainly, of a hearing, and going to Baskett's court would not have been to the point. She's the basement Department 10 commissioner. In any case, I think they got tried, and they are going to get a decision from Baskett, and I am not optimistic, but, one can always be wrong, and judges can always change their minds. People can have religious conversions. Big Rock Candy Mountain can suddenly appear out of the Pacific. Actually, I kind of doubt it, but we'll see what happens. Let's hear some more, however, from Pacific Avenue. And this is from September 6th. I guess it was on Sunday or Monday of this week.
And perhaps we'll hear more about that. Does that sound fair enough, Al? Yeah. So, that's all I've heard from down here after a somewhat turbulent talk with Alex and Joff. Alex was concerned that perhaps some of his legal strategies were revealed. And we have another display device with more paintings down here. Nice looking display device, also on wheels. It's kind of a similar box shape. Who are you? Oh, yes, I think I've seen the author of this display device. And we have that infamous jeweler woman. How's it going? How are sales today?
It's good. It's calm and beautiful weather.
How long have you been here?
1 hour.
Have you been advised you have to move along every hour?
No, I haven't.
Excellent. Good. You're doing fine then. And I see you have no blue boxes around you, which is also good, actually. I'm glad to see that. And you, however, are within 14 feet of a bench, but you do have you have the blue box T-shirt. Congratulations. Why aren't you wearing it?
I just got it from the people over there.
It says, I was in the blue box.
Yes. There's no bombs.
And there were some T-shirts issued in support of Abby and Keith, two activists who were unceremoniously arrested in the middle of the night at the Freedom Sleepers group for allegedly creating additional blue boxes on Pacific Avenue, which would expand the performance spaces of performers and vendors and so forth who have been, contracted by the tender mercies of Julie Hendy and Company. The previously the redevelopment agency person, she's got another title, but she's one of the key people there that helps to crunch people into smaller spaces, make things orderly, so that's what these shirts say. There was it's something about I was in the blue box, or I'm in the blue box, or some such thing. And you can see something. I actually have one of those shirts myself, so you too can get a shirt. You might find them at the Food Not Bombs events, which happen every Saturday and Sunday from 4 to 6 at the main post office, or near the main post office in Santa Cruz.
It's a support of the two Food Not Bombs 2, the Blue Box 2, who are facing misdemeanor charges for adding additional blue boxes for performers' benefits, all of which, including the original blue boxes, have been removed by the city. And we've been talking with
Marcella.
Marcella, anything happened today that you noted you want to pass on? So there seem to be many artists, well, three anyway, with three large displays on the street. And here we have Lucero Luna, a Phutnot Bomb / Freedom Sleepers activist, at her table. What's going on here, Lucero?
Free entertainment?
You're doing some free entertainment?
In Santa Cruz.
You're doing a
Phutnot. Freedom to sleep, freedom to entertain, freedom to sit, freedom to drink in public, freedom.
Just general freedom. Now, I see you have the old street spread. I hope to get you the new one shortly. I'll drive by and give you a copy of it if you want. And you also have Phutnot Bomb's literature, Join Freedom Sleepers literature. Mind if I take a few of these?
Take them.
Thank you. You have free radio. You have Huff literature. I just took the last rubber band, and it is now about to blow away.
There's no rubber band.
Good. And looks like this table is overflowing with literature.
Yeah, it's called the condensed little table that is going to fit in my pet mobile, otherwise known as the Jarrah Connelly 95.
That's quite a mouthful you got.
That's right. And have you heard of the Braceros?
I have not.
Well, you should. Shame on you.
Indeed.
And the country.
Indeed.
The nation. That is not so great, and the America, who is not so beautiful.
I knew, if you're talking about Braceros, you're talking about the workers in the fields?
So. My father.
Your father?
Yes, I'm a descendant of the Braceros.
Which Braceros where?
From the 1940s and 50s and 60s.
Oh, you mean the people that were...
The Trinity.
The ones...
The curse.
You mean the Braceros that were kind of imported into the country to break labor unions who are already here? That was the ones you're talking about?
The ones of the United States and enslaved.
The Bracero program.
And for some, actually, the pre-exam was fumigation with DDT and forced to work. Slowly kill themselves with the mini hoe.
But they picked a lot of lettuce cheaply, man. Come on.
Yes. We like it so much, I'm here again.
There you go, see? I mean, after all, you didn't die. You did just fine. What are you complaining about?
Yeah, really. It's take back.
Take back
the money. Take back whatever that were supposed to be promised to the Braceros.
See. So, Lucero, how long have you been out here today? Give me that rubber band so we can put that on here.
Well, can you tell my face? I've been here exposed to the elements and the take back Santa Cruz of you. How long? Look at it.
I can't tell, babe. You tell me.
I think it's like all day.
It feels like all day. You look. I have a weathered face, but it's still a sweet face, I got to tell you. So what you say, have you had any interesting encounters that you want to pass on?
No, not much interesting encounters, or just like, just walk away for the table, no questions. No, we don't have any questions.
No $10 bills?
Actually, one
got a donation cup here, I see. Yeah. You got a $5 bill there.
It was a $10 from over there. So
that was
we'll
nice.
Take them, kiss his ass, too.
Yeah, well, I will be back to take my cut soon. And we've been talking... Walking up and down Pacific Avenue and about. Oh, goodness. And for Artisans Gallery has a freestanding illegal sign. The Imagine Positive Change meters. I count three of them so far. One in front of Heavenly Couture. And then there were two up near the New Leaf area on opposite sides of Soquel.
And what I'm doing here is something I've talked about probably too much on the air. The commercial signs you see that are sort of in a shape of an A that are in front of stores that are sort of freestanding are illegal. That is to say, there's no permitting process. They're not supposed to be on the sidewalk. They're not a criminal violation the same way that it would be illegal for a homeless person to, I don't know, sit with a dog and peacefully spare change by having a sign or sit next to a building just to rest. Those are illegal crimes, and they're criminal violations. But the violation of the signs, the ordinance, which does not allow you to place freestanding commercial signs, is apparently a civil violation, although I've got to be honest, I'm actually speculating a little bit here because We've talked, we at HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the civil rights group I work with, have talked about actually going around to the merchants and saying, look, we believe that human beings need to have the same rights as your signs. And if you'd like to sign a petition supporting that, we will support your right to have signs here. Otherwise, we will attempt to, you know, to advise the city that there are numerous criminal violations or civil violations, actually, or whichever, along Pacific Avenue. And that's something we talk a lot about. We've been jabbering about it for years. And who knows? One of these days we may actually do it. So watch out, all you businesses with signs.
I have third-hand information from Geoff Jones, but it still may be accurate, which is, first of all, first-hand information was you saw Officer Ewan give you a sort of a positive symbol,
yeah,
as he walked by.
Gave us a peace sign.
I have a quick question. Anyone you guys saw a debit card anywhere around here?
No.
Oh,
better call your bank.
Okay.
Bummer.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No worries.
So you're out here again, this time in artist garb, as you have a kind of a, your artwork is sort of, you look like you've been painting, you have a sort of a...
apron,
thank you. You have an apron on, and but you have your display device is out here, and no blue stripes yet, but the third hand word is that there's new brackets, blue brackets, due to appear any day now?
You know, by third hand information, I mean, the man is telling the police, who's telling one of the other artists that was out here, but he was just saying that they were going to re-implement the rules and kind of put the blue brackets back and really start enforcing it. That's the words that he used, but who knows, maybe they'll finally look at all the shit that they stepped in.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I was in error about one of the laws that the... it was explained to me that one of these sections that actually... Well, according to my new understanding of the law, the current law is... It's completely illegal to have any kind of display device unless you're inside these boxes. And therefore, everybody along Pacific Avenue who has a display device is illegal because there are no boxes.
Yeah.
Is that your understanding?
That's as far as I know. The boxes were here, and then they took them away.
Because I know that in the past, prior to the boxes, it was, 14 feet from here, 14 feet from there.
Yeah.
But, and while it's still 14 feet from here and 14 feet from there for panhandlers and sitters, it is not 14 feet for a display device. There's simply no, although I've got to perhaps review it again to be sure, no place to put a display device except inside these non-existent boxes.
Yeah, well, if they bring the boxes back out here, we're still not going to set up in those boxes. At least I am not, speaking for myself. I'm not going to continue to be in these boxes. This is a rule that actually expired in June, and they're still going around arresting people, giving people tickets for a law that doesn't exist anymore.
Now, let me admit my error here, because I think I've given you a misimpression here, and you need to look over the law again by going to...
I did.
You did?
Yep.
Well, maybe... See, I talked to the mayor, who doesn't know shit from Shinola anyway, but who nonetheless drew my attention to the section of the law that was expiring. The section of the law that expired on June 30th was not the entire law. It was only the section 4 itself, which stated something to the effect of, unless the city council passes a resolution by June 30th, 2015, then this... this section will expire. What that means is that the boxes section continues, but the expiration date stuff goes away. So my new understanding of the law, which I do not necessarily suggest you follow until you read it yourself again, is the law stands as it was written last November or October, and is just as simply has no longer has that expiration section in it. It doesn't expire. It has, in fact... become the law that everything has to be inside bracketed boxes that is a display device. Now, I would like you to look it over and see if you agree with me next time you check over the law, because you're a man on the streets who actually is confronted with this shit all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I hope that she comes back and buys something from you and takes you home with her as well.
Oh, hey. Yeah, I wouldn't complain.
So I understand from Keith McHenry, who was your only supporter in court who showed up, that you guys were put at the end of the agenda. Is that true? Or?
Yeah, we went on last.
And how long did it take you before you actually could you were called up by Commissioner Baskin?
Let's see, we got there at about 1:30. We were in court until about 4:30. We were at the stand for maybe 40 minutes, 35 to 40 minutes.
So you actually talked to her for 35 or 40 minutes?
Well, I went first, and I let her know that I have some information that I would like to read out loud, and I have a copy of those documents if she would like to read along. And she just had the bailiff grab it, and she was like, "Oh, I can read faster than you." Ha.
Did she read it aloud, or she just read it silently?
No, she read it silently, but she did acknowledge the things that were put in there, which I can't disclose too much information.
No problem. Did your presentation include the actual law, the municipal code?
Yes.
Did she make any comments on that?
Yes.
And did she say anything that might be relevant to other street performers?
I'm not going to say anything that she said. Again, secondhand information. I would just be kind of giving a general idea of it. But needless to say, it's being analyzed right now. They're kind of processing what is going to happen.
They or you as well?
Well,
you took notes, I take it, or you have mental notes?
Yeah. They'll give us a heads up of what's happening is what I'm trying to say.
It's really too bad that no one was there witnessing this, because it was a public hearing, but there was probably no recording made of it since it was an infraction. And Joff and Alex have this, what I think is kind of a hyper-paranoid deal, where they don't want to talk about anything that goes on in court. It has to do with legal strategy, yada, 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 which I can understand in some circumstances quite appropriate. Here, I don't think it is. That's my opinion, because what a judge says is public. But it's only public if the people who hear it pass it on, because the judge isn't recorded in these things and probably isn't giving a written opinion, the commissioner in this case, Commissioner Kim Baskett. So what Kim Baskett's response is to this kind of stuff, I think, is very important to people on the street. And it's important that it be passed on. And it's too bad we weren't there. Had I known, as I said, that they weren't going to disqualify this commissioner, they're just going to stand there and... I guess they were there in their constitutional historical outfits, you know, as Benjamin Franklin and George Washington, which I think is great theater and also quite relevant to the issues, slaveholders though they may have been at different points. But it's important, I think, not to get lost in the sort of mega secrecy where that does not get out to other people. In fact, Alex was quite upset with me, because I did post that they were intending to disqualify the commissioner, which I thought they had agreed to. It was a public thing. It was going to save people the trouble of coming to their hearing, because it wasn't going to be anything. It was just going to be a word disqualifying you, and then go to the next hearing. There would be the real trial. But it all became wrapped up in a sort of a secret legal strategy, I guess, which is too bad. But so far, they're back on the avenue, selling their stuff, displaying their work. There are no boxes there. There weren't yesterday or the day before when I was walking around. So that's all to the good. Let's hear some more. And maybe from you, your phone calls, 427-3772. Give me a call.
Now, did you actually go to trial? Was a cop there who was making the complaints?
Our arresting officers were not there, but Bush was, who is the sergeant, I believe.
And what kind of testimony did he give? Or did he?
I can't say anything about his testimony, to be honest.
In the sense you don't remember, or you're choosing not to?
A little bit of both. I can't put words into someone else's mouth, really. I can't quote exactly the things that he said or the case that he presented, but it could have prepared him a little bit better.
Was he, in fact, making the complaint?
Not really. He's just doing his job, just talking for whoever he's working for.
But did he... See, someone has to make a complaint against you. It has to be Bush... or an individual citizen, or maybe the city attorney.
I don't think I haven't heard any complaints from anyone. We're just artists out here showing people pictures.
Oh, I don't say legitimate complaints.
Ah, yes.
I mean, I'm talking about something where it says, "Oh, it's against the law. That's why you're here in court." So the cops who took you in to court must have thought you were operating illegally. Therefore, they took you to court, right?
I suppose.
And therefore, was Bush one of the officers who originally took you to the judge?
He was not our arresting officer, so.
But he was, in essence, testifying before Baskett about the case.
Correct.
Now, at the end of all this, did she give you any indication of what her verdict would be or what was coming up next?
No. It's just all being processed. They just got you on it for a bit, see how it tastes.
Now, you did not enter a plea, as I understand it.
Correct. There was no plea.
Did she say, "I'm entering a plea for you"?
No, Gallagher did.
Gallagher entered the not guilty plea.
Correct.
Now, was this actually a trial that happened that day, or was it an arraignment?
I think it was a trial. I have no idea. I just went to court, was there. Let me be completely honest with you. I was not all there during that time. As a matter of fact, I had surgery the day before, and that day I had a following procedure where they removed a tube out of a place, which I will not explain.
Whoa, you don't need to do that. You're frightening me already.
Yeah, okay, so I was slightly impaired physically.
You were distracted.
Yes.
And that's a large snippet, almost an hour of the show from September 10th, 2015. If you want to go to the Huff website, you can track down the full show. But now we're going to be moving on in this patchwork show today. Today now being May 5th, 2022. We're going to check out Berkeley activist and attorney Andrea Henson, who is actually camping out with her clients and her friends in Berkeley in solidarity against the harassment of some of them by authorities as part of the Where Do We Go encampment that she and others have defended for over 2 years, and they've also defended themselves. This interview kind of goes into that in some detail, and here it is. So today is the 5th of May, and it's about 3 o'clock. I'm on the line with Andrea Henson, who's an activist and also a civil rights attorney. I'm not going to hold your attorney status against you, Andrea.
Thank you.
Yes, but the fact that you're an activist gets especially high marks in my book. You're actually talking to me from your campsite, which is, where are you located anyway?
I'm at 2nd and Page in Berkeley, California.
Where is that, for those who don't know the city?
Berkeley is right outside of Oakland and San Francisco. It's in the East Bay, they would call it, the East Bay of the Bay Area.
And where in Berkeley is this Page Street address?
It is right near the Gilman District, which is Gilman is a freeway exit, and so it's right over there. It's the industrial area of Berkeley. Berkeley's not that big, but it's the industrial area.
Now, I passed through Gilman going on to that exit for another reason yesterday, and it looked like there were a lot of RVs parked in that area who I thought had been driven out of Berkeley. Is that also am I mistaken about that?
Well, they haven't been driven out necessarily. I don't want to say it, all of them. Some have gone to a safe campsite called Horizon. There's about 45 RVs there. And then many are along 8th and Harrison on one side of Gilman. And then on the other side, going south, are more RVs.
Huh. But you aren't situated next to an RV. You're in a different spot.
I am. I would say it's a hybrid spot, so it's RVs and tents.
And how many folks are encamped there nearby with you?
I'm not really sure. We just moved here yesterday. So typically there are RVs in this area. There are very few tents. But the reason why we moved to this area was, now we can talk about the driving out. Mm-hmm. All of the encampments along the I-80 corridor have been swept. And then people have been swept in tents along 8th and Harrison. And so we made the decision to move our clients here. Most of them had decided to come here, and then some who didn't know where they were going to go. We brought them with their former campmates, and so we all moved here. And the reason I moved here with them is because a rogue security guard was harassing and viciously verbally attacking a homeless woman. And so because we've had court cases and we've had preliminary injunctions and now it was time to move, there was really no other choice than to move in next to her and near another woman who moved from Berkeley to Emeryville yesterday during a sweep and then was told by the police that she couldn't be in Emeryville. We picked her up and brought her here. And so I moved here because I'm tired of the most vulnerable people being harassed and attacked. And if anyone shows up, then their attorney will come out and defend them.
And how many of your clients are in this area now?
I want to say about 10 to 12. I haven't actually done the count yet because it's been so busy. But I would say approximately 10 to 12.
Now, this is part of the encampment, Where Do We Go, correct?
Well, yes. The encampment, the folks in Where Do We Go were all a part of the encampments along the I-80 corridor. So it was made up of four encampments, which were the Gilman encampment, the downstairs, which is the I-80 underpass encampment, the Seabreeze encampment, which was the I-80 overpass encampment, as well as Ashby Shale Mound. And all of those individuals were a part of Where Do We Go.
And how many?
And so,
how many people did this constitute? Sorry.
In the beginning, we had approximately 150 to 160 people.
And this was over what kind of a period of time did these four encampments exist in the form that you described them in?
They started off small. I would say the first one being like probably 5 years ago, and then existed when I got involved in 2019. They were in place, and that's when we stopped the evictions for 2.5 years, and then they started up again.
What directed your attention to these encampments in 2019?
In 2019, there was a coordinated effort to evict people. At that time, you had Berkeley PD as well as Caltrans coming out to the encampment. So when someone would be evicted off of Caltrans land, the CHP would harass them and tell them to move on. And then as soon as they stepped onto the sidewalk, Berkeley PD would tell them they had to move as well. So there was really absolutely no place that they could go.
And Liberal Mayor Jesse Arguin had nothing to say about this?
Not at that time. At that time, they said at first there was no, coordinated effort. However, I was there, and that's how this all started, was because people had all of their belongings taken. It was horrible, and there just was no place to go. And then eventually, City Council joined the table, and really Caltrans was the one who came to the table with us and met with us and coordinated with us. And then their director changed, a lot of things changed, and now the sweep of the final encampment, Ashby Shell Mound, occurred.
And this was a relatively recent post-COVID sweep that happened after, because I understand you got an injunction that was lasting over several years in one form or another, but that sweeps then began anyway. And when did this be? Tell me if I'm mistaken in any of these understandings.
Yeah, so we never, I apologize, we never had an injunction initially. temporary or preliminary. We actually negotiated with Caltrans, and that's how the sweeps had started. It stopped for 2.5 years. And then recently, about 6 months ago, when they started sweeping three encampments, that we brought a case arguing that under the ADA, because we went from 160 people down to, I would say, 25 people. And these are all just very rough estimates. And so the folks who were left, who hadn't been housed or moved, these were our most disabled. And so they couldn't go into congregate settings. They needed more accessible housing. But more importantly, they needed more time. Their disabilities required that they have extra time to access services. Sometimes when you have severe mental disability, and this could be, you know, PTSD, schizophrenia, et cetera, anxiety, it takes longer to organize your time, appointments, et cetera. You need assistance to get those things done. And so that's what we argued, and Judge Chen at the time granted us a six-month preliminary injunction.
This was for 25 people, more or less.
The first, I believe we had, I want to say, I can't remember in the first lawsuit, and then they got housed, and then the second one, I believe we had 11. But he recognized that there were other people on site. We were given like a weekend to amend the complaint, and so we went out and talked to people. So by that time, I think we had about, I want to say, and I could be wrong, it's like about 20 people. 11 known plaintiffs, and then those that we had mentioned to the judge who were evicted from Seabreeze and who ended up at Ashby Shell Mount.
Now, the 100-plus that were driven off after the Caltrans arrangement apparently was either violated or failed, what happened to them?
So they weren't driven off by Caltrans. I'm not going to say that, because we actually, for 2.5 years, we worked with Caltrans. I mean, we partnered their director, Tony Tavares of District 4, who's since moved on. He worked with us, and we would do cleanups, and we installed porta-potties. And so those folks were provided with services, and they were able to find housing, or they moved away, or, you know, different things happened. And then at the end, they started these evictions where people, some of them had not even been approached at all for services. Some of them simply couldn't access services because of their disabilities.
Now, I notice in reading this decision, well, maybe you should explain what happened on the legal front that maybe it's not important because it's a little obscure. I was trying to pierce my way through the, I guess it's Judge Nelson's reversal of Judge Chen's essentially attempt to give your folks more time. Is that a proper understanding?
Yes. I'm sorry, there's a lot going on.
That's okay.
Outside. Yes. And so the idea was that that 6 months was too much time. But they were looking at a variety of factors, including Caltrans brought up the Sanchez decision, which was another decision involving property. And so that talked about, you know, how much time people should be given. And so, of course, we have some dispute about that decision. But when you're working on the ground with people, much of my time was just the preliminary order was expiring on April 30th. That was even before we went to the Ninth Circuit. So that didn't stop. So while the Ninth Circuit decision came down, we still knew that we had to move, and that that what was at issue was not to extend that preliminary injunction. Because Judge Chen, we requested another preliminary injunction, and that's when Judge Chen extended it for a month to April 30th.
And so
that makes sense.
You weren't looking for another one after that.
Yeah, so So the original one was supposed to expire in March. I'm sorry, I should have explained that. Mm-hmm. The six-month one. And then we asked for four more months because a few things, setbacks had occurred. One, the coordinated entry system in Alameda County was dismantled in November. That means everyone who was on that list for housing needed to be reassessed. So we had a few of our clients who were first on the list for housing, but who lost their place, and then because of a lot of administrative error, other people weren't reassessed, et cetera, which is key to housing. And then we had some other setbacks. And so because of those things, we argued that people were getting services. We didn't want to displace an encampment. As you know, when you displace people, and we can't find them, they have to start over with their services. And we worked so hard. We didn't want to lose that 6 months that we had gained to find accessible housing for these individuals. But the judge only gave us a month extra. And so April 30th was the expiration of the preliminary injunction. And so all the court was ruling on is the first preliminary injunction, which, you know, was really moot because it had already expired. I know it's very complicated and obscure, but for us, the focus for me was how do we get these folks who still, and this is something that I think homeless activists and the unsheltered feel, is that it doesn't matter what we do in court in terms of what's happening. The lawyers are working. I'm working. But what's happening on the street is daily survival, right? So there's these arguments happening in this, you know, in court, and then there's what are we going to do when the eviction comes? So it was a lot to work on.
So are you now without legal options in terms of extending this injunction still further in a legalistic way?
Yes, that would be moved because everyone has moved. So we're all at second and page. So that fact pattern, that issue has come to an end now because we're here at a different place. And that's why I'm here, because this was really the last place to go. And here, the women were being harassed. And I just wanted to make sure after these folks had been evicted from several encampments, right, most of them had come from the other encampments and moved to Ashby Shell Mound and then had to move again. And like I said, these are the folks who are suffering with severe disability, who were very vulnerable. They needed more than what court could provide at this time. They need an advocate. They need someone to stand up and speak for them and stop people from harassing, you know, at least be able to be a buffer. So that's what my plan is.
Can you describe kind of the physical surroundings of the place where these folks are currently living and where you are encamped yourself?
Sure. So we are on a city street. It's an industrial area. There's lots of businesses around. It's extremely loud at night. It really comes alive. I was surprised because during the day it's quite quiet. And at night, big trucks are coming through, lots of cars, lots of building. You can hear various machinery. And it's a street full of RVs and tents now. So it's a real hybrid. It's an isolated place. But still, the business owners don't want, like most places, they never want to see the unhoused.
What kind of businesses are there in this area? They mostly cater to tourists, cater to upper middle class people, cater to community folks in the neighborhood?
No, I don't know. I'm not as familiar, but it looks like metal shops, very industrial, commercial places, a lot of big trucks. Things like that. This is not a retail district. This is not a residential district. This is very industrial. So it looks like old steel mills and things like that.
Is there any sense of community among the homeless community or the unhoused community that's there, both in RVs, cars, and on the ground?
Absolutely. Just amazing. And when I can say that when I came, the RVs were very kind and brought chairs and helped us. We moved, you know, on the sidewalk. We brought a lot of tents and we brought people. And that could have been, as you know, like a lot of encampments are are set communities. And so I'm very grateful that everyone here was very kind to us, you know, bringing these additional people here. So I feel like there is a very much a sense of community.
Is there any chance for any kind of, protective organization forming among the campers themselves?
I'm not sure. It's our, we just moved, right? And right now, I think people are getting used to their surroundings. My colleague, another attorney, brought coffee this morning and pastries. It's just, you know, waking up in a different home. You know, even though people are homeless, they still get used to where they're at, right? And it's become comfortable, and now they're not comfortable. So I would say I'm here to act as a buffer, and then in a few days, we'll start to talk about our next steps, right? Because I want to give them the opportunity to sort of relax. They've been packing for days. Like I said, some of them have been moving their stuff with bikes and bike trailers. I'll call the city while they rest, you know?
Mm-hmm. And how many, I was going to say, this is your first camping out experience, or you've done this before?
I've done this before. I did this at the beginning of Where Do We Go, Berkeley. So after those coordinated evictions, I moved into the Seabreeze encampment for the same reason, because many people at that time didn't have the resources to call quickly when Caltrans would arrive. So I moved in so that I do have resources. And so I'm not going to say that would be demeaning others to try to act like, oh, I moved in, so I'm unhoused too, you know. But I did come in to live here because I know that I could call people faster. And in this case, you know, everybody was so weary. Once again, it was that same dire situation where it was like, I'll put up a tent because you're not going to mess with my client. You're not going to yell at her or threaten her. I could be here as a buffer because she's exhausted and she's tired and she's disabled and she's moved many times. And so that's why I came here, was because of the gravity.
Mm-hmm. And again, going back to your earlier support and your earlier encampment, how long did you stay?
I was there. The first time I stayed a little over a week, and then I went back. I can't remember if I stayed several days. I know I kept a tent. One of the residents kept my tent. So I would stay on and off, like a day here or a couple days there, depending on what we were being threatened with. And then once I felt that everyone, that threat had passed, then I moved out of the encampment. But I always had my tent there.
Indeed. What was the effect of your staying in the prior instance? I mean, was there an abrupt change in the behavior of the harassment? I guess I should ask, what kind of threat were the folks facing on this first encampment experience you had?
So the threat was eviction. And so the first time, three of us refused to move, or actually four. It was two elderly women and one young woman whose partner had been killed by a train. Two gentlemen at that time had been killed by an Amtrak train here in Berkeley. Or maybe it was Union Pacific, I can't remember. But we refused to move when Caltrans came, and then they left. And then the entire encampment, both upstairs and downstairs, made a decision that they just weren't going to move. And so I was a part of that. So when Caltrans came, I called activists. And I sat with, at that time I wasn't a lawyer, and I was just an activist, and I hadn't passed the bar yet. And so I sat with them, and we just didn't move. When Caltrans came, we started picking up garbage, but we didn't get up and move things. And then Caltrans left. And so after that, we wrote an open letter to the mayor and to the director of Caltrans. And the director of Caltrans met with residents, and they told their stories. And that's when we started to work together to create a more humane way to solve the homelessness problem, by working with resource providers, by putting in porta potties, by cleaning up the trash and having trash pickup. So it was really a solutions-focused refusal.
I guess I've asked you this before. It's a little puzzling to me. You said most of the folks who were not so much swept away but moved away or got alternate housing. My impression has been that the crisis for unhoused folks has increased, not diminished in the last 2 years, although there have been massive amounts of money supposedly made available. What's your sense of that, since you're keeping an eye? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm sorry.
I can. There's no problem. I have no problem with the dog. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. No. Oh, sorry. Someone's helping me with my dog. He's a little under the weather. Uh-huh. So I think the issue, your question is, have I seen that increase with homelessness?
Yeah, because I really am wondering why Caltrans' perspective changed. And why you were, was there actually an emergency, an exigent situation that required forcing people to move from where they were previously?
We don't believe so. One of the encampments was swept because there was a fire. But that was one that could have been mitigated. Fire is always an issue in homeless encampments, right? And we did try to mitigate that with fire extinguishers, et cetera. But for one of the encampments, the extinction circumstance, I believe, was real estate development. And the other was aesthetics. The Seabreeze encampment, everyone would see that. It was across from the Seabreeze Cafe, and so the city would get a lot of complaints. And I believe that after COVID, they decided to start evicting these encampments and tried to say that there were critical situations, but they had been in existence for a long time. They'd become very organized and centralized with services. So that's why, and we were so close, like I said, to getting everyone housed. So I don't believe that there was anything really serious, just the end of COVID and real estate development and aesthetics. You know, poverty is ugly. It's not pretty. Mm-hmm. And it's not supposed to be. And a lot of people who are housed and leaders don't like the look of it. It makes them uncomfortable, as it should.
Was most of the housing, first of all, are we talking about cheesy shelter space, or are we talking about real long-term housing when you talk about housing?
I was talking about real estate. Like one of the encampments, market rate housing went up. They say it's affordable, but they only have like 6 to 8 units that are affordable. So because of that development, the homeless individuals got swept. It wasn't the availability of housing or because affordable housing was being built. Mm-hmm. It's the development of land that was the reason why people had to move.
Now, I understand that, but I guess my question is, because of those, of the many people who have, you said, gotten other accommodations and
yes,
been helped with housing, has that been mostly inside Berkeley, outside Berkeley? Has it been mostly short-term shelter, or has it been long-term, affordable, not affordable is a bad word, housing that's really affordable, not this crap that they use to describe housing that's affordable to upper-middle-class people sometimes. So
I would say it's a little bit of everything. COVID actually brought in a lot of FEMA money, so the Project Room Key hotels, I feel like, created a model that was workable. Because of the FEMA money, people were moved into hotels where there were housing navigators and case managers who helped to get them into temporary supportive housing and then into permanent housing with a voucher, subsidized housing. And so we saw much more housing of people during COVID in the Project Room Key hotels than before.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks have moved into apartments, which is wonderful. And so I really believe that that model during COVID should continue. The difficulty is now with COVID over, the FEMA funding is evaporating. So Berkeley, for example, applied for a grant, but that money is, that $4.7 billion to do something similar to the Project Room Key Hotel, is earmarked only for the eviction of homeless residents at People's Park and for the eventual closure of a shelter so no one else could take advantage of those opportunities when money's earmarked like that.
Mm-hmm. Was most of the housing, so-called housing, found inside Berkeley? This is question number one. And question number two is most of the Project Room Key and House Key housing shutting down now?
It is, but it's transitioning. So cities and counties are turning the hotels into either permanent supportive housing, temporary supportive housing, or as in the case of Berkeley, the roadway, which was our Project Room Key Hotel, is turning into temporary supportive housing for those at People's Park. People are getting housed in Berkeley, but very few. I tend to see more vouchers being given for places like Alameda, Hayward, Oakland, and even further out. Mm-hmm. So in Berkeley, it's very hard to find housing where you're at.
Is there still a determination on the part of people who are unhoused in Berkeley and approached by the police to move to assert so-called Martin versus Boise rights, or is that gone by the board?
I don't understand your question. Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. In other words, you're familiar with the Martin versus Boise decision, obviously.
Yes.
So that, of course, for listeners, is the decision that says unless you can provide housing or shelter, you cannot criminalize someone who's outside in terms of giving them things like camping tickets, presumably putting them in a position where they can say, come back when you've got something to show me that's really, you know, some really accessible housing that I, let's say, as a disabled person can use. Are people resisting that in Berkeley, or is it only in this, what sounds like, I'm wondering if it's a rare case of your coming in to be supportive. I guess I should ask, were you called in by your clients to say, help, you know, and did you say right on, or did you see this and come in to volunteer, this most recent chapter here?
We've been with them from the beginning, and so as the eviction started, things were going really, you know, they weren't being threatened, and so myself and the other legal team members were not as involved. But then as the notices came out, the threats of notices came out, that's when we got involved. And Martin v. Boise, like you said, applies to the criminalization of homelessness, some sort of citation being issued. In this case, folks weren't issued citations. It was the threat of this where the harm would be that they would be placed in a more dangerous position. And that they were given housing, but that housing was not accessible.
And in what sense, if you care to comment on this, was it not accessible?
Well, for example, you would have people with severe trauma and disability who could not stay in congregate shelters. It would literally affect their disability. You know, PTSD is not a memory. It's a reliving of an incredible traumatic experience. And so these group settings were just unable to accommodate people who had terrible trauma.
Now, did you have to prove any of these disabilities? Or was there sort of a good faith understanding with Caltrans authorities that, you know, this was a situation that was real, and that initially sort of smoothed the way for this kind of understanding that you had over the last few years? And if that's the case, why do you feel now that it's no longer in force? Or is it? I mean, I don't know.
So in this case, I'm sorry, I'm trying to do a few. It's getting a little crazier. In this case, anytime you in this particular lawsuit, normally you wouldn't get experts and whatnot until until you start to get ready for trial during discovery. At the preliminary stage, we did tell the court about the disabilities that our clients had and that they had been, some had been diagnosed with them, most had been diagnosed long ago, right? Many times people who are homeless don't see the doctor, right? They're not going to have those recent records. But we did have a psychologist look over their declarations and what they had said about their previous disabilities and agreed that a congregate shelter was not accessible for them. You know, trial process is long, and getting that type of evidence, we weren't at that stage yet, but we provided what we needed to based on the law at this stage. But still, what our case was about was what was a reasonable accommodation under the American with Disabilities Act, and we were given 6 months, and the Ninth Circuit said 6 months was too much. But by that time, our preliminary injunction had expired, and now we're at getting people, these last folks, into accessible housing, safe housing, a place where they're not going to be harassed on the street, not in such a vicious way by someone who's like a rogue security guard. We don't even know yet. We'll see when he comes back. Everyone talks about this person, goes through it, terrorizes them.
Folks have their cameras ready? Or?
Yes, they've had pictures of them, but, you know, that's what I'm waiting to meet, whomever this is, because we've had many reports of this person and then other business owners, but it's just to be here to say, you know what, there's nowhere for them to go. We're working with the city, and, you know, we've done everything we can in court, and now we're here, and if the city can provide us with a safe place for my clients to go, we'll go. As long as it's, you know, they're safe and they feel safe and they're not going to be, you know, verbally assaulted.
And for those folks who want to follow this, your continuing struggle here, and their continuing struggle, I should say, where can they go online to keep abreast of events, be supportive, look in, that sort of thing?
So where do we go? Berkeley? If they look that up on Google, where do we go? Berkeley has turned into the organization that we honored that's turned into 501c3 nonprofit. It's run by Ian Rogers, and they can go to that website to find out more about what Where Do We Go Berkeley is doing and how folks are being helped. I work very closely with them since we started the organization back when I wasn't practicing law, but now I'm with the East Bay Community Law Center, and so I work very closely so they can get updates from there or follow us, like I said, at East Bay Community Law Center. There'll be updates on their social media channels.
Mm-hmm. And has your experience as a lawyer, do you think, impacted your perspective on this?
It's added more remedies, but it's allowed me to advocate, you know, legally, but many times when you're helping those who are unhoused, you have to look for many alternatives to solve problems of the most vulnerable on the street to protect them, because the law may not always be the answer, right? It can help you, but sometimes, you know, it may not go your way, and the people on the streets are still suffering. They're still being harassed. They're still being swept. So I think being a lawyer has helped me to advocate more and provide stronger advocacy. But you always have to be adaptable and flexible to defend your clients in the best way possible, whatever that may be.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What's your sense of the situation for folks outside in Berkeley coming out of COVID with the shelter in place essentially gone and Martin versus Boise perhaps largely ignored? What's your general sense of how Berkeley authorities are responding? Is it simply sort of now an engine to facilitate real estate developers and conservative residents, or do you see something else happening?
I feel like there are fewer places for homeless individuals to exist. And I think that that is not just a Berkeley problem. That's a California problem. And that because of COVID, homeless populations are increasing. People are more transient, and I think that we're going to have to really come up with more realistic solutions. And it's not just going to be a shelter opening here and there. It has to be people who work with these populations and do needs assessments and develop programs that are more accessible for vulnerable populations. And we're seeing that in Berkeley, that, you know, there's just fewer places to go, and this is an example of that. So everyone came here because there is really nowhere else to go. If you go downtown, there's sidewalk ordinances. You know, you can't be in residential areas, of course, and homeless individuals don't want to be. They're human. They want to be respected. You know, these places are out of the way. But there's just nowhere to go. So we have to come up with better solutions working with city leaders. We need more pressure. And it's going to get worse before it gets better. I hate to be cliche, but...
Much connection with Oakland unhoused folks in their encampments, which I take it are larger and more extensive.
So I've been working with residents at Wood Street and advocates there, and it's the same thing. Caltrans is going in and starting to do sweeps. People are being moved. It's the same argument. It's that it's, you know, unsafe, it's dangerous, but poverty is unsafe and dangerous. You can't just keep pushing people to different places and not expect the same thing to happen, right? Albert Einstein said that's insanity. And so I think we're going to see more, much larger evictions and much more displacement. What I've noticed in Oakland when I go to those encampments is the lack of services. In Berkeley, I see more services, and it's still very difficult to get people housed. A lot of unhoused folks in Oakland don't get any direct outreach from service providers. And so they haven't even started those processes. They get moved with, you know, nothing. And it could be as simple as an EBT card, getting food stamps or cash aid. You know, that helps. Anything helps to start the ball rolling for housing. And I don't see a lot of that in Oakland at all. The people I meet, I always ask them, has anyone come out to talk to you? And they always say no, unfortunately.
Are there any large encampments left in Berkeley?
Second and Page.
Right on.
Here There is still there.
People's Park for the moment?
For the moment. That's going to close in June. They're remodeling the roadway to move all of those folks inside because they're gonna raise the park and build student housing.
Wow. Well, I'm running down, but I'm sure there's a lot I haven't asked. Is there anything that you would like to be asked that you would like to comment on?
Yeah, I feel like this was just really thorough, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And I will definitely keep people posted. This is, you know, quickly changing, and I'm just, you know, you've always been with us from the beginning since we started Where Do We Go Berkeley. And so I'm so grateful to be on your show and to be able to share the stories of these incredible people, my clients, who are just so amazing and resilient despite the horrendous things that are put on them just because maybe they don't have enough money or because they have a disability, things like that. So I just really appreciate the support of your show and of all your listeners. It means a lot to us out here.
Well, I don't know how many listeners I have, but I'm glad we're documenting this, because although I'm sure you're documenting it in many other places, does KPFA give you much coverage or not?
Porn Magazine, Dagger Radio Show on KPFA, and so they were out here today actually talking to us. They've always been extremely supportive since the beginning. I don't know about KPFA, you know, regular reporters. We have had coverage. But, yeah, maybe things will change again. We were fortunately, no one was covering us because things were going so well. That's good.
Indeed. Until the axe falls, of course.
And it's fallen, yes.
Well, you sound in great spirits, and I'm impressed. So I will probably get back to you and find out what's going on to follow the continuing saga, and get back to me if you want, if you feel there's something you want me to put out one way or another. And I will suggest that people check out where do we go, Berkeley, to see what's cooking there. Just check on your browser, and any listeners, to check in on what's happening with the folks that Andre Hansen is spending time with here and camping out with and trying to stand up for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Jay, you too.
Okay, have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And coming up next is Wes White, who's a California Homeless Union activist who covers a lot of things throughout the state, or seems to know a lot about them anyway. We reached him by phone at the Huff meeting, as I mentioned at the beginning of this in Netcast, and he patiently answered a lot of questions that I had and gave a lot of information that you're about to have, so enjoy him.
But why don't we give Wes White a call and see what his update is on
that. If he's available, because he may be busy.
Right. Let's see if we can reach him. And then I'll continue going through the rest of the agenda.
Okay.
Hey, Wes. Robert here. It's at the Huff meeting calling you and recording everything you say.
How exciting.
So, we got something on Signal that mentioned some ne'er-do-wells being cleared out from their illegal squats in the Carmel area. Do you have any further information on this?
Yeah. Well, basically, we just went down there, and, well, the services came to bear. There was McHome, there was CSUMBCHA, there was in the parks, California State Parks, there was the Monterey County Sheriff's, and code enforcement being one. So there's probably about, I don't know, 18, 20 members of services providing resources. So everything the county can come to bear did. They plan on evicting people on the 8th of May in 3 days, which happens to be a Sunday. And also Mother's Day.
At what time is this supposed to start?
At 9 a.m.
And what kind of so-called resources are they providing, or are these the usual lists and waiting lists and that sort of thing?
Well, the only thing they've really got that's tangible is going to be this three-day hotel voucher, which I imagine they're going to give on Sunday for Sunday night, Monday and Tuesday, which makes them back out on a Wednesday.
And is there any move to do a injunction to stop this, given the Martin versus Boise claims?
Well, the county's legal position is that Martin versus Boise don't count because, after all, it is private property.
Is it private property?
Land Trust property.
Big Sur Land Trust. Is that private?
Yes.
Cole was here and she had a birthday.
Are they a public property that they can move on to nearby?
That's an
interesting. No, not really.
How many people does this affect?
Oh gosh, I just put out the number. I think 15 people.
Okay. And is there any plans for documentation on Sunday other than you being the ever faithful video man?
Right, which I don't know if I'm going to make it or not. Still, I don't know. It is Mother's Day after all. I might have plans. But a few people already have using the hotel voucher for 3 days. I'm going to try to talk to the supervisor about making it her position that they should, you know, she should want them to stay in. You know, they uprooted them from their home, now provide a home, you know, or allow them a place where they can be. Because what they're doing is not solving the problem. They're doing the same thing they always do.
You don't say.
Which is nothing.
So, are these folks that you previously had much connection with, or do they call themselves anything, or they have any kind of solidarity, or are they simply likely to be blown away with the wind here?
Likely to be blown away with the wind. A lot of them work, and they're just trying to survive where they're at. Mm-hmm. So I was able to talk to one new guy and talk to one guy that I saw the last time. They've both chosen to take the voucher, and from that I'm going to try to make sure that they stay in, you know, not just only 3 days, but that they're afforded a full ride. Since Social Services wants to entangle themselves with these folks, try to get everybody onto it. Then that way, hopefully, the county realizes a better gravity of the situation.
Wes, is there any indication in terms of actual requirements or mandates that, other than your pleas and, you know, endless, do the right thing kind of speeches to them, do they have any reason to actually expand this? I mean, is there funding that they have to expend by a certain time? Is there a directive from Board of Supervisors? Is there anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, this all comes from the state, you know, a lot of the money. And, of course, a lot of it's allocated toward cleanups, you know, which is how they're saying they're addressing the problem, which is not the case. They're going to be working on Mother's Day, dude. I mean, you know, this is like double time, holiday pay, something.
So, anything happening in Salinas?
Oh, I did get a message from you.
Yeah. Anything happening in Salinas?
Well, a lot of people got knocked off of the Union Pacific Railroad tracks. All their possessions taken. So, many people are without even a tent, a blanket, clothes, food.
When was
everything?
This?
Last week.
And how many people would you say were impacted?
400 or 500.
Oh my!
And where did they go, or do you have any sense of that?
Well, they have to start over. Some people are, you know, no matter where they land, guess who's there? The police. So even when they leave that place, they're still being persecuted everywhere they go. So from that, they end up with nothing. So they're still with nothing, and desperately looking for tents and blankets and everything. Where they're at is next to nowhere. I mean, you know, wherever they do set up is obliterated and confiscated.
Have you been following any of them in terms of where they went? Do you have any phone contacts with any of them?
I have a little bit of contact with the folks at Sanborn. You know, the folks along the, in Chinatown, they just scooted over the other side of the train tracks onto the city side. City's tolerating it for now, but, you know, they have an overarching goal not to even identify them. That's why they threw everybody on the train tracks. So then that way they can say, oh, you're on private property. You don't exist. We don't have to help you.
Any word from Monica Tone?
Any
word from Monica Tone on the Watsonville Pajaro River folks?
They've been kind of quiet, more or less. I don't know exactly what's happening, if things are happening. I mean, I think people have been kind of on the run, you know, just sticking to themselves and trying to stay undercover. I don't know. I would imagine some people are still at the river.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Sausalito, as you probably know, since you really have been keeping tabs more than anyone on what's going on around the state with different homeless encampments, and in Novato and in Petaluma, places of that kind, Chico, homeless folks have gotten together with attorneys or gotten together with legal workers and gotten injunctions or at least a kind of solidarity. They even filed individual lawsuits to challenge attempts to abusively treat people in those encampments. Have you gotten any sense that either in Watsonville, Salinas, or in Carmel, this place we were just talking about by the Rio Road, that this has happened? Has there been any kind of solidarity or pushback?
Well, the one guy I talked to did mention that he really wished there was some kind of catalyst. He was like, you know, we need another Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, somebody. And, you know, so there does seem to be interest in that. You know, he's like, someday there's just going to be a revolution, man. You know, so a something liberation army. And, you know, it's like, okay, wow, you know, I mean, and this dude go to work. You know, he packs everything up and compartmentalized to go, you know, so he packs in and packs out, you know, and he works. So it's like, you know, and that's the third person I've come across, fourth person, everybody works, or at least that's what they've stated, you know, and it's just mind-boggling. I mean, just struggling to survive. You still need cash, and you still need a place to be, and how much does it cost, and, you know, what are the requirements on paper that you need to even get there? And no wonder you get people outside. So we're not trying to solve the problem. We're trying to have a perpetual soccer ball. And these folks are, they're doing well, actually. I mean, I've